from Prinzburg. Rather than have them sit through the rest of it, I would like to start with Prinzburg. Is Representative Junkie in the room? He's not here yet?
He's planned to be here at 1.
Pardon?
He's planned to be here at 1.
At 1? All right. I think we should have him here. I think we should have him here. So let's go to the department here. Let's run through perhaps the which program did you want to go through first?
I thought I'd go through head start.
All right.
And I'm going through the budget pages now.
Okay, I'm going to have Mr. Crow first talk about the pages you'd be in your budget book, the spreadsheets, et cetera, that you would be looking at. This is the time, members, when you can enjoy your budget book.
Madam Chair and members, I just wanted to point your attention to a couple of things. One is that in the front of your budget book under the tab called something budget recommendation.
Okay.
There should be a copy of the spreadsheet that looks of this memo that I handed out last week. Ooh. And then a copy of the spreadsheets for aid and levy. And as we talk about early childhood programs, you'll see on the spreadsheet for appropriations, if you look on page three of four, between lines 123 and lines 147 are the family and early childhood programs. You can see for fiscal 2006-2007, the base budget's about $80 million for early childhood and family support programs, about $5 million for prevention, about $72 million for self-sufficiency and lifelong learning on the aid side. And then in your budget book, the early childhood and family support area starts on page 267 and goes for about 40 pages after that. So that's where you'll want to keep your attention as we talk about early childhood programs and some of these other programs.
All right, Ms. Carlson, where would you like to begin?
Madam Chair and members, I'm going to start with the Head Start overview, which is on page 278, I think you have.
All right, members, if you would find page 278, I think it'll be helpful for you to have your books open and be able to look at that as we go. Go ahead, Ms. Carlson.
Members and Madam Chair, you may remember that Head Start is a program that's funded with both federal money and state appropriation. And the federal monies are in the ballpark of about $83 million, go directly to the 34 Head Start grantees. And they do not pass, it's like Monopoly, they don't stop at the department, they do not pass our go sign. They go directly to the local grantees. In addition, however, the department disperses the appropriation that you all set for those same grantees, and the governor is proposing, you'll see on the budget page in this section, the governor is proposing that to be $17.1 million for each year of the upcoming biennium. You can see in the little box over to the right, in 2004, the 34 Head Start agencies enrolled over 16,000 children, and about 2,400 of those then were served with the state funds. The state funds are appropriated in the same way that the federal funds are, so that the per child cost that the Fed sets for each program is the same per child cost that the state money funds. Head Start serves primarily 3 to 5 year olds from low income families. The families must be at 100% of the federal poverty rate or below. 10% can come from above income, and 10% is also reserved for children with diagnosed disabilities. The services provided in Head Start are pretty comprehensive. They include not only a preschool education component, but health services, transportation, assistance with housing, parent education, and adult education. So, and in addition, you can see here we have said in our document that 70% of the referred families also receive mental health services through Head Start. The average sort of typical model of a Head Start program is a center-based model with the children coming for part of the day, but there is also home-based Head Start, and particularly for very young children, some of them do serve children under three, and in greater Minnesota where the distances are between families are pretty far apart, then they sometimes do home-based program rather than bus children a long way to a center. The programs are, in this state as well as nationally, starting to cooperate and coordinate with full-day child care programs because more of the parents are working now and can't support that model of just part-time. You can see that, you know, remember the program started in 1965. It's a program that started a long time ago. We didn't appropriate money, however, until 1988. It was the first year. In our at measure section, you can see there that 30% of the children enrolled attend full day, so the coordination has increased a bit over time. On the next page, it just talks about how the money flows, and I think I've already gone through that. Oh, and in addition, there's a Minnesota Head Start Collaboration Project. Each state has a collaboration project which is funded federally, and we get about $100,000 for that, and that the purpose, we have a staff person, is funded with them. The purpose is to try to increase that coordination among all the early childhood programs with Head Start.
Mr. Carlson, can you just tell us in the say over the last 10 years, how much of an increase have we seen in the number of children served? I know that the federal dollars have continued to increase, and at some point in time, probably about 10 years ago or 8 years ago, we increased the state dollars quite a bit also. So how many more children are we reaching now than we were reaching maybe in 1990, for example?
All right, Madam Chair, I think I have a chart here with me that might in 1990, is that what you asked?
Something that looks at least 10 years back is what I was.
Actually, it looks like, for some reason, I have a blip in my chart here that's erased for a couple of years. But in 1988, the first year of state funding, we funded, with the state funds, 819 children ages 3 to 5. Then, let me give you another marker. In 1998, which I think was the first year we increased to 18 million, we funded 3,155. So you can see the difference there.
3,155?
Yep.
Okay, and in the meantime, what happened with the numbers that we handled with the federal dollars?
Okay, I can tell you that. To the federal enrollment, the comparable federal enrollment to the 1988 figure is 5,407, and the 1998 figure federally funded is 9,869. Now I can tell you that, let's see, I think in 2004, so that would be one of the years. 2003, there was a cut. So the
small cut.
That 3,155 went down in 2003 to 2,446 with state funds. And with federal funds that year, it was 10,896.
So can you just say how much of the federal funds gone up since 1988? What's been the growth in federal funds? I'm trying to determine how much it is costing per child, and whether or not we are gradually increasing the number of children, commensurate to the federal funds that are coming in, or whether we are not.
It looks like from my chart in 1988, the federal amount was 12 million, but a little over 12.5 million. As compared to 83 million.
Ooh.
Now, so the federal increase has been quite dramatic.
So we have an an increase of 83 million and we're only serving twice as many kids as when we had 12 million?
That's what the numbers say. Now, I can tell you the per cost of this year, but I don't have, you know, going back 10 years and certainly going back to 1988, I don't have the per child cost with me. But the, and remember, the per child cost varies across the 34 grantees. So I can give you a statewide average cost per child for 2004 is $6,886. But the range goes all the way up to $12,338 and down to, it looks like the lowest amount is $5,800. But I don't have those per child numbers back.
That chart that you were looking at before when we were talking about the numbers served with the dollars?
Yes.
Do you have, is that something we could make a copy of and distribute to the committee? Okay, so when you're done with it there, maybe you could give it to Mr. Walsh.
Sure. I might be done with it unless you have any other questions.
Are there any further questions regarding Head Start? I mean, this is kind of your chance to ask questions about the program. Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Is it Ms. Olson?
Carlson.
I knew it was standing in the back. Thank you. I'm sorry. Of the number of students enrolled in the federal programs, does that include those who are served on reservations, or is that separate under the federal?
Madam Chair and
Carlson.
Representative Erickson, that does include children served in on the reservation in those programs.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Erickson,
do you have that number available?
Yes, I have it by White Earth, Red Lake, Mille Lacs, Leech Lake, Grand Portage, Fond du Lac, separately. Maybe you want a copy of this chart too for the
company. I guess it wouldn't hurt. It certainly wouldn't hurt. Representative Bisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, has a longitudinal study been done on the students in this program to, number one, measure the effectiveness of the program as they enter school, but then number two, to look and see if there's any long-term effects, i.e. as they've been in the school system for 3, 5, 12 years, has there been continuing benefits from the Head Start program?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, there has been no state longitudinal study, but there have been actually a few federal longitudinal studies. There's a lot of Head Start research out there, and I'm not prepared to talk about it in any kind of depth, but there are longitudinal studies that show the benefits. There are also studies that show there can be some fade out of benefits during the elementary school years, kind of midway through the elementary school years. There's a lot of research, not all of it compatible with each other.
Okay.
If you want us, I mean, we can try to do that with you, or the Head Start group probably knows that better than I do, but certainly we could.
Well, I think, Ms. Carlson, what we're looking for, and at some point we can probably have Head Start in here specifically to talk about it, but to get some sense of where are we getting the most bang for our buck, so to speak, and which programs are bringing children along better than others. Is our, you know, readiness program better than Head Start in doing that? Because as we look forward, and we know there's a lot of pressure to increase what we do with early childhood, we're trying to determine, I think, as a committee, what is the intelligent thing to do? What are the programs that are working better? What are the ones that are not great, et cetera? I think we're trying to learn more about what each of them does.
Madam Chair, there is a federal study that hasn't been released yet, too, that we just got kind of a little blurb on a listserv about that. It's getting ready to be released. It's a longitudinal study in the nation of like 2,500 children, and you might recall that last let's see, a couple of years ago, they instituted what's called the National Reporting System in all the Head Start programs, and they have looked at literacy and numeracy skills, and that is close to being released. So maybe when...
Will that include Minnesota? I mean, will that study have specific numbers for Minnesota?
I don't think so.
Can you get those? Were there Minnesota students included in this?
I don't think there were.
Oh, great.
Now, also, there was a study done by St. Paul Foundation in Ramsey Action Head Start program over a specific literacy curriculum, and we could get you that information, too. That's a narrower look at readiness, but certainly.
Okay. Representative Grinning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a topic that we all should look at, and we have in the past as well. My concern is that we cut $11 million out of early childhood programs last year, and I think we all could agree that, you know, this year hopefully we can put that back again. But exactly where we put it and how we do it, I think, is open for debate. And, the program Head Start has received a lot of criticism over the years, and I myself have always been a big supporter, but I'm certainly open to what can be done to change it, you know, if we need to change it in any way to make it work better. I've heard people even like Dr. Mark Davidson from the university say it needs some changes. And so I think, you know, I would rather than, you know, try to figure out exactly what to do, if we could have a meeting where we have people that come forward with recommendations, or which one do they like better than the others. You know, I think they all fit different needs, and so, you know, having choices is that maybe the best result we could come up with. But if there's any program that we have that could be changed, you know, I think we'd all like to hear recommendations from Commissioner Carlson and anybody else that knows more about it than a lot of us do.
I will take that as a statement, not a question, right?
That is right.
All right. Representative Erickson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, you know, when the money comes into the Head Start program, does it come in small chunks, large chunks, or chunks that would support the health program, the nutrition program? Are those all separate pieces of a large grant, or do they all add up to the final grant?
Madam Ms. Chair and Representative Erickson, no, they do not come in earmarked, so to speak, for those services. They come in at the per-child cost, and then the services are kind of matched to the child. So,
Madam Chair, Ms. Representative Erickson, does the Head Start site then determine how those dollars will be used based on the need?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, my understanding is that there's 17 states that have a state component of Head Start, of which we're one, and we are second in terms of the effort that we put forward as a state to Head Start. Can you characterize what we get for that, maybe compared to other states that have less of a state component or no state component? What are we getting for that? Are we serving more kids? Are we doing more for the kids that we're serving? Can you talk a little bit about what we're getting for that additional investment?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, we are getting more children because we distribute it in the way that the federal money is distributed. So we're... Essentially, we're buying more slots for more kids with the money.
Representative Demmer, do you have
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah. So, I guess I'm not sure. Does that mean our thresholds are lower, so we allow? I mean, I don't know exactly. Is our threshold lower, so more children are allowed in? Then, do you mean, or you say we serve more kids? And in what way? Do we have a different criteria then that we've made more inclusionary or something?
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer, no, we have the same criteria as the federal. So the federal amount will let's just hypothetically say they'll fund 100 kids. Then, with the state appropriation, we're able to add 20. More children to that 100. And so the 120 children in that program are served exactly the same way. I mean, they have their services kind of geared to them, but nobody gets lesser or a greater amount of service.
Representative Dimmer.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess I phrased that wrong. I wasn't thinking that there were. But how do you figure out which 20 to add? If somebody else is serving through the federal 100 kids and we're serving an extra 20 kids, how are you determining the extra 20 kids?
Madam Chair,
Ms.
and
Carlson.
Representative Dimmer, there is in statute the formula to get at those other kids, which mirrors the way that the federal formula. Do you want me to read it to you?
Actually, we are serving, about half of the eligible children at this point in time that would be eligible for Head Start?
Madam Chair, I believe so. We don't track that. You know, that figure usually comes from sheer eligibility according to income, and so that doesn't necessarily match the capacity, for example, of the programs to serve that. So that is, I think, what the federal marker is, that, you know, state by state, that we're about half.
Okay, I have one last question for you, Ms. Carlson. It's just because I'm looking at the numbers and trying to understand what's going on. In 1988, we were putting $12 million federal dollars into the program, plus some state dollars. We served with the federal dollars 5,400 people. Now, we are in 04, we're putting in $83 million, which is substantially multiplied times 12. And we're only serving twice as many children, 10,800 type. Now, why aren't we serving almost twice as many children? Has the cost of serving per child gone up that much?
Madam Chair, it would be due to the cost of per child. Yes, the cost of serving the children have gone up. But again, I don't have that referent, so I don't.
So when the federal dollars come in, Ms. Carlson, do they come and they're just to increase quality of the children already in the program, or is it to add children? Seems to me one of the goals would be to always be trying to serve more children, and it doesn't appear that that's what happens under this program. I've never seen these numbers before, so I'm kind of surprised.
Madam Chair, and I'm not sure that does happen all the time. The feds figure out the cost per child in each site. Then they appropriate the money based on that. So often, it doesn't automatically mean that you get an increase in children every year. So whether it's only the cost of services has increased, or you're increasing some kind of service, actually, and that isn't necessarily the same across all the grantees.
All right, Representative Dabney.
Madam Chair, you made my point about the percentage of eligible children not in the program because of funding.
Okay.
Thank you.
And this will be the last question, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, the range that you talked about, is the high end because of disabilities, perhaps?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, actually that high end, the 12,000, let me get that chart, let's see. Right. is actually mostly due to transportation. That's in an Indian reservation where it's really, really expensive and to transport the kids to the site. And that's really what raises that. So that's kind of mostly we take that number out of the range because it is so much higher than the next highest.
All right, Ms. Carlson, I think we'll interrupt. Thank you for this. We'll go on with the next program. But first we will hear the bill. Since I see Representative Junkie has joined us, we will go ahead and hear the bill and then come back to the early childhood programs. So, members, change gears, pull out your bill. And this is House File 248. And I would recommend House File 248 be recommended to pass and sent to the Tax Committee. Okay, Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Thank you, committee, for allowing me to come before you with this bill. I'll give as brief explanation as I can. I've got out-of-town guests here at the table and board members from District 815 and McCray in the audience, and we want to get them on the way as soon as possible also. Members, this is what's called the 815 bill, Prinsburg, Minnesota. Very unique situation. First of all, this bill we did pass last year, for those of you that were there, was in the tax bill in both bodies. And we know what happened to the tax bill last year, so we're back this year. 815 basically has an outstanding debt owed to the McCray School District over a number of years. 815 is a unique district in the state in that it has no students, public school students. They operate a community Christian school there, and they do have some special education programs, but as of this year, all their students are open enrolled to McCray that aren't going to community Christian school, so it's a unique situation, members. And last year's bill asked for an excess levy vote, a levy that they would vote on and be imposed to pay off their debt. Since the bill did not pass, they actually went ahead and held the referendum in November, and now that referendum, which was a positive referendum, is contingent on this bill passing. The reason that it's here before you today is we've got a deadline somewhere between February 18th and March 1st to get this to our assessor to get it on the spring tax rolls. And if we don't do that, working with the department and others on this, 815 faces a dissolution of the district. So it's, we're kind of under a time crunch here, and that's why the bill is moving in the Senate right now. They heard it today and moved it out, and we're hoping to do the same here. I have Greg Bonema here with me. He was a member of the citizens group from the 815 project to answer any questions you may have. And, Madam Chair, maybe I'll just open it up to questions or perhaps hand it over to Greg for a few comments.
Representative Jahnke, I do have a question for you. The bill that we see before us, were there changes made in the Senate bill this morning, or did it pass as is?
Madam Chair, I believe as it is, but Greg was there. Maybe he can answer that question.
Mr. Bonema?
Did they do any amendments to it, did they?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that the bill passed as it is, but it, we know of a couple of changes to that bill.
There were changes?
Will likely be made.
That will be made in taxes.
Right.
Madam Chair, I do know, and I was going to talk to Mr. Strom, who helped draft this. There's a question on the back page, page 4, lines 9 and 16. Rather, the reference to Section 1 should be to Section 3. We're just wondering if that's a drafting error. And then number 2, the whole second section has to deal with how they determine the amount owed. 815 and McCray have come to a determination on that amount, and so we'll be drafting an amendment, hopefully, and attach it in taxes to simplify that the amount for the first 3 years is $282,000 is what's due to McCray. That'll be made in 6 equal payments as the taxes are collected over those 3 years to the McCray district. I should also mention to the members and also the Finance Committee, this is not an equalized levy, so there is no public dollars involved. And in fact, the fiscal note you got, if you have it, said $5,000. That would have been if we needed a commissioner's hearing to determine the amount of money. We won't need that now that they have an agreement on the amount, so that should go away also. It's actually a zero cost to the state on this bill.
Representative Jahnke, I think what we would prefer to do is make the change here.
Sure.
That needs to be made, and we will ask Mr. Strom to develop that language so that we can send it on to taxes as pretty much a clean bill.
Did Mr. Strom get all that from me as I was...
Madam Chair, Representative Jahnke, on the timing of those 6 payments, is there a schedule that's been worked out today?
6 payments, two a year, June 30th and December 30th of each year, starting this year.
And perhaps you talked about the money that is owed. Perhaps you ought to give us an explanation of why Prinsburg has a debt and is owing money at this point in time. Mr. Bonema, do you want to do that, please?
Madam Chair, thank you. and thank you to the members of the Education Finance Committee for allowing us to come here and present our situation. The district, because of it is a common school district without, for quite a number of years, it had very few public education, relatively few public education students, and at this time, since those students are open enrolled, effectively zero public education students, and many of the funding mechanisms relating to public education are tied to the number of pupil units. And our district, in regards to funding, had limited funding available, and the levy limits of the last several years did not allow us to adequately levy to continue to operate as a district. And in addition to that, there was a disagreement between the two districts 815 and the McRae district, which of course has been resolved, at least tentatively, and we feel that is almost certain to become agreement. And because of that disagreement, because of our funding difficulties, the levy limitations, we were not able to levy ourselves. The district fell behind in regards to their financing.
Okay. Are there any
Madam
questions?
Chair, I should also mention to the committee, this is a five-year referendum. They will have to come back every 5 years. The first 3 years are the payout to McRae and an additional amount to pay for their ongoing special education costs, which they still do in the district in a building within Prinsburg. The last 2 years, the McRae costs will drop off. The levy will be reduced substantially just to those special education costs. And they do need to renew this every 5 years and make the commitment that they still want to maintain the District 815 as a district. So we think we have some good safety factors in there for everyone involved.
So actually, with this last part, you will no longer require some mediation from the department because you guys have worked it out.
That's correct, Madam Chair. In all likelihood, the entire Section 2 could be eliminated because the dollar amount has been worked out.
All right. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I do want to explore the whole idea of why District 815 wants to exist in the first place, and instead why they don't just make a formal merger with the McRae School District. It would seem, from an just a fairness issue, if all of their public school students are now going to the McRae District, why the property taxpayers of Prinsburg would want to be treated differently to support the school district. To me, it's a broader, more principal question. Why should we as a state encourage district, not encourage, but at least allow District 815 to continue to be this rather odd school district? So throw that out there first.
Mr. Bonema?
Madam Chair, District 815 takes the education of its students in its district seriously, and we do provide adequately for all of those district students. At this time, there's a private school located within the district, Central Minnesota Christian School, and many of the district students attend that school. District 815 provides significant amounts of special education services to those students across the street from that Central Minnesota Christian School. District 815 has a reputation for doing an excellent job in educating those children. And we believe that that's very important to the residents of our district and to those children attending that school. In regards to whether that's fair that we ought to continue, we believe that as long as we provide for that education, we feel that that's important, that we have that option to do that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative
Gerlach, or Biskins, excuse me, sorry, he's a senator now, right?
Senator, he's worked his way down.
Yeah. I agree. The other thing is, in rural Minnesota, as you know, school districts are a source of community pride. I think that's part of it, but also they're laying the groundwork for the people to come after them. If they ever do want to build a public school building and have a public school district, they have preserved that in Prinsburg, and
You know, it's a small, about, what, 500, 600 folk community, Dutch Reformed, very unique in Minnesota, and they take a little pride in their district, too, and that's really part of the reason they want to preserve this, Madam Chair, and I know that sounds sappy, but it's true out there.
Nobody said it sounds
okay.
Representative Biskins, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I did, and I guess I can appreciate that. I do, as I look through statutes, notice that we have means for geographic areas to come together to consolidate. We have means for geographical areas to detach from one district as long as they attach to another. But it does strike me that there is a process missing in statutory language for a geographical area to detach from a district and become its own, which is an issue I think we need to deal with as we look at the massive consolidations. So I do appreciate that. However, it does make some interesting conundrums here. And another one that is a precedent that I'm a little concerned with, all right, is if we were to allow this to move forward, what kind of precedent would we be putting into this process, which would say, to a school district, go ahead and levy above the cap, even though the law says you can't, because if you do, we're all such good-hearted people, we're going to fix it. At the legislature, and so that is a concern. I don't think there was any ill intent meant by the people of Princeburg, but it does create a precedent, I think, that we should be very careful about. So, Representative Junkie, your thoughts on that, being a lot more senior in this process than I, to speak to the precedent, I think, would be helpful.
Madam Chair, thank you for that question. I agree with what you're saying, and I know you're going to see a lot of excess levy bills come through this committee, or at least asked to come through this committee for similar situations or unique situations in everyone's mind. A couple points to me. First of all, back to the point of consolidation of their district, I will assure the committee they have had and are having ongoing discussions with adjoining districts, but at this point have not provided none of the surrounding districts at this point are willing to take in the Princeburg district either. And if they do dissolve, as you know, they would be assigned to districts by the county board. That's how that process works. As to the excess levy, another unique situation here, and again, Representative Biskins, I would not recommend this to anyone in the future, and I don't think it ever happens. There was never a written, signed agreement on the cost of educating, the tuition for the students that went to McCray in the past. There was never an agreement. It's the old, we'll do things on a handshake and get along with things. And unfortunately, in this case, that handshake and the monies that came from the state and forwarded to Raymond got separated. They are now putting together, both boards will have resolutions, and they will have this signed, sealed, and delivered, the amounts due not only now but in the future to run special education or other incidental costs that may be there. So it's in this case, it's the old handshake problem that we had, too, and this debt got out of hand. But I do agree it's a tough precedent, and I agree it's even tougher for us in rural Minnesota because our tax value is a lot less than where you come from, Representative Biskin. And if we do start allowing more and more excess levies, we really get out of whack. I do agree with you on that, and it's something we do need to watch.
Are there any further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. How many students there are enrolled at the Christian school?
Madam Chair, I believe there's 300, about 340. Yeah, approximately.
Representative Heidgerken.
Yes, thank you. Just a comment to Representative Biskin's comments. I don't think we have to worry just too much about establishing anything here. I think there's only two common schools left in the state of Minnesota. This is one of them. And the other thing I want to congratulate the Prinsburg district there with, I think they passed the school bond, the referendum with 85% or something. So we want to put some stipulations there. We most certainly could, but I don't think we have to worry about it.
Well, Mr. Strom does have language. It should be coming back. Okay. And we'll have it printed up to give you so that we can go on with, finish this bill up. So we are, as you know, members, making an amendment that refers to the back page, the recertification process, that subdivision. Appears we can almost eliminate that because they have come to agreement. And also, you're saying on line 9, it should be a 3, not a 1. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think on line 9 and 16, it probably should be required by Section 3 and according to Section 3 on both of those.
We've got, I suppose, a minute or two before he gets back with those amendments. Do you, is there anybody else from Prinsburg who would like to make a comment?
Well, Madam Chair, we do have the Board Chair of 815 and of McRae. If any of them are interested in coming up and just affirming what we just talked about, we certainly can. Why don't we get McRae up here? And
yes, why don't we hear from McRae and make sure you're okay with all this? Sir, would you introduce yourself, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Palkey. I'm the board chairman at McRae Schools. We are very much in favor of this bill. We believe it's a win-win situation for both schools. We think it's a great way or a great thing for kids. It will service kids very well if this bill passes. Part of the thing that will happen if it does not is that the special education needs of the students at the Christian school will have to be taken over by, a large part, by McRae. We had our superintendent and special ed director take a look at this, if it did happen. The most economical means to doing that for us would be to transport those students to our schools, which is probably about a 10-mile distance between the school buildings. They would have to be transported over and transported back. I have never been a proponent of busing students, especially during the day. It's an absolute waste of time. So we believe doing special education there would do those students the best. I don't think it's very often that you get an opportunity to do something good for students without any cost to the state. I would hope that you would pass this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Was it Palkey?
Palkey.
Palkey. And did the head of the Prinsburg board wish to say anything? Might as well. We've got a minute or two. I hate to interrupt this and go to something else because I'm sure Mr. Strom will walk in the door immediately when I do that. That's usually the way things go. You're Mr. DeBoer, right?
That's correct. Madam Chair, I serve as the president of the board of District 815. And District 815 has been serving students for the special education intent mandated by the state of Minnesota and in keeping with all of the rules and regulations of that. And with that special education service, the fee is probably greater than, and the cost is greater than that which is allowed by attendance per resident student unit. But we do provide that kind of service, and the parents who have children in District 815 are desirous of having that special education continue. We took that kind of idea to the community, and the community said by over 85%, yes, let's continue to have local control and provide this kind of service in town. And like Mr. Palkey says, we don't want to have special education students receive their special ed on the bus to and from another site. And that's why this bill would be very beneficial for the children who need that service. And we would encourage it to be passed.
All right, thank you. We will have a vote on this as quickly as possible, but we have to amend it before we can do that. So, since Mr. Strom isn't back, Representative Junkie, why don't you stay there? And let's just, Ms. Carlson, what was the next program you were going to cover? Pardon?
Well, here we are. See, I told you. I just should have done it sooner.
Done that sooner.
This is called a dramatic
pause. Dramatic pause while we pass out the amendments. Did you have a speech, Representative Junkie?
Well, again, Madam Chair, the amendment, the way I read it quickly here, basically deletes Section 2, inserts the dollar amount they've agreed on, $282,000, divided in six equal payments on June 30th, December 30th of each year, and then changes that back page, the Section 1 to Section 3 reference, which I think was a typo at the time of drafting. So that should get it into the form that hopefully we'll just speed through Representative Prinke's committee then once we get there.
Representative Junkie, I would move this amendment, and I think we're all fully informed and ready to vote. All those in favor for the amendment now. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Amendment passes with no dissenting votes. Amazing. On to the bill, House File 248. And the chair would reiterate my motion that House File 248 pass as amended and be re-referred to taxes. Any further discussion?
Yes.
Representative.
Representative Junkie, I congratulate you on your brevity. I hope that you continue this Saturday morning at Wilmer, all right?
Thank you.
All right, I believe we're all well informed and ready to vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Bill is passed. We'll go to taxes. And thank you, Representative
Johnson. And, Madam Chair, I do want to thank the committee because, again, this was such a special case. We're under such a time constraint. You know how the legislature, we're still going to have to get the taxes, get to the floor, get three readings, get it to the governor's desk. It's going to be a chore by March 1st, but I appreciate you helping us out on it.
Thank you. Ms. Carlson, or whomever, you said readiness was your next program.
I believe it's on page 272. School readiness was a program that was enacted first in 1991, sort of as a state answer to Head Start, actually. It goes, its intent is to look at risky kids, if you will, and try to get them ready for school. Their districts can, let's look in the little box first. There's about 79,815 children and parents participated in the program in FY 2003, and we should have the 2004 numbers pretty quickly. You can see that 20,000 referrals were made from other programs. And you may recall in this program, many of the children that participate are referred from screening, from early childhood screening. You can see in the population served that there is not an income requirement here like in Head Start, but there were 5,251 children were identified with developmental delays through the screening. 28% of the parents had no more education than a high school or GED diploma. 29% of the participating families did have household incomes of less than $30,000, and of that, 4% of the families had incomes less than $10,000. 22% were headed by a single parent. The way districts do this program varies. A lot. Some districts have standalone school readiness programs, if you will. Many districts add this to their ECFE budgets and do maybe an extra day of child-only time in their ECFE programs to get to address this population. There's a little list of things. Some do readiness programs in child care settings. There's a $9 million appropriation for this spread out across all the districts. So there's a great range in what districts receive for this. I think it's important to understand that this is not, in no way are the services comparable to the Head Start services here. This is not comprehensive like that. Actually, I can tell you, I think it's like Milroy District, for example, gets $1,400 for a year to do this program.
What kind of a program
so they
you?
Can't do much with that. Minneapolis, of course, gets the highest appropriation, but that's still under $1 million. It's like $957,000. So when you break that down on a per child cost, you don't get anywhere near what you're what we just talked about in the Head Start program.
Ms. Cox, and what kind of results are we seeing? Is the program helping students to be ready for kindergarten, I guess, is what we're doing here.
Madam Chair, that's probably an answer we're going to have to get from each district because the program varies so greatly across the districts. I know Minneapolis and St. Paul have good information on their kids and how they enter kindergarten in their own with their own district assessments. Minneapolis particularly has collected that data for quite a while. We don't do that on a statewide basis. Now, you may recall that we presented at the second year of the school readiness statewide profile to this committee last year, but we don't know which programs those children are in their preschool years. We just know how they're coming to kindergarten in those first 6 weeks. So we can't trace back to the origin.
Ms. Carlson,
of where
do the
time.
Do the students in the various preschool programs that we have, do they get a MARS number at all? Are we able to track their performance so that we could look and say, well, gee, these kids went to readiness and it's making quite a difference compared to the control group? Do we do that? Can we do that?
Madam Chair, currently, this is a great segue to the governor's proposal, which we're not talking about today. But the only preschool children that receive MARS numbers are special education students that are less than kindergarten age. However, we do propose to, in the governor's budget, we propose to give MARS numbers at early childhood screening so that children as young as 3 who are screened then will get a MARS number, and then we would be able to do what you are asking. We're just winding up the writing of the third year of our school readiness study, and in this year, instead of taking a profile of the whole state, we worked with selected districts, entire districts, rather than just enough to do a random sample. This year, we worked in every school in each of the selected districts, and in that design, we were able to assign MARS numbers to those children. So we can tell you that if you want us to come back and tell you about the study when we finished. But up till now, we haven't been able to do that.
Madam Chair. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, I think Princeton is one of those, is it not? In
Princeton.
School readiness? Princeton?
Oh, yes.
Princeton.
In the third year, yes. Thank you. I want to just point up in the little box.
Hold on one second. Representative Cleansing, does your question apply at the moment?
It applies to school readiness in the early screening.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just wondering what the early childhood screening, first of all, at what point does that take place? Is it optional, mandatory? Is this something done by the medical professionals when kids are showing up at the pediatrician, or is it done formally to the school district? Can you explain that process at which a kid would actually go through the early childhood screening in order to be referred into school readiness?
Ms. Carlson, were you going to get to the screening this morning?
Actually, Madam Chair and Representative Prinzing, I thought I would do the screening program when the governor's bill came out, because we do have kind of a little early childhood proposal that revamps the screening program, makes significant changes to the screening program. And so I thought rather than do an overview of the current one when we're proposing.
Could you just give a really abbreviated description of how it works?
It is mandated once prior to school entrance, and you can be screened either through the district's programs or at your own health care provider. You can just submit that documentation of screening. Just have to have evidence of the child being screened prior to school entrance. I just wanted to direct your attention up to the box where I read the program statistics. I think the third bullet is maybe the most critical bullet. Of the 79,815 participants, only 21,000 of those children received 30 or more hours per year of services. So that's an important contrast, I think, to the Head Start program, too. If you think of 30 hours per year is not a whole lot of service time. So,
but there are some districts that have
two or three
days a week, mm-hmm, or something like that.
Yes, Madam Chair, they do. And like I say, I think St. Paul is a good example of that. You might want to even talk to them separately. All right, the next program I was going to do is ETFE, and that is on page 269. And I think maybe of all the early childhood programs, they have the most familiarity with that one. It seems like everybody kind of knows about their neighborhood ECFE program. You can see there that last year we had about 315,000 children and parents participating. We know from early estimates that we're down about 9.5% or so this year in participants. So, and I can get you those numbers when it gets when they get more defined. You'll recall All Families is a universal program. All families with children ages birth through kindergarten are eligible. You can see the services provided, a typical ECFE program. You have a couple-hour program once a week where the child and the parent interact with child development specialists, if you will, for the first hour, and in the second hour, parents are led by a parent educator and parent discussion groups, and the children are in a preschool-like experience with other children, or toddler, or even infants. We serve in ECFE. Began as pilot programs in 74, ran to 83, and in 1984, community ed could have ECFE programs in any district that had a community ed program.
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
And it's the historical perspective part there.
Oh.
Where the council, in the old days, the Council on Quality Education ran the pilots, and then before they went into all the districts. You can see that we have some good feedback from parents who have been in the program. We did a study in 2003 on the levels of parent involvement in kindergarten and at grade 3 from parents who attended ECFE versus parents who didn't. And you can see that the parents who did attend ECFE read more regularly to their children, visit libraries more regularly, and certainly participate in PTAs and parent activities once a child is in kindergarten and beyond.
Excuse me, Ms. Carlson. Yes. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, you indicated a few minutes ago that early data indicates a 9.5% decrease in participation, if I understood you correctly.
Yes.
To what do you attribute that decrease in?
Madam Chair and Representative Abney, I'm not sure we know that. And I think it varies probably enough among districts that there may be very different answers in districts. You know, maybe a capacity space issue in a district, maybe that the costs have gotten too high. There are a variety of reasons, and I don't know that we can give kind of statewide reasons.
Thank you.
Also, what is happening to that population between 0 and 5? How much have we, there's a downturn in that population group, but do you know about what it is?
No, I don't, Madam Chair. We can get you that, though, the census figures, you mean? How much the, mm-hmm. I just don't know that off the top of my head.
It's okay. Representative Erickson also had a question.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, to what extent are you able to track at-risk children or at-risk parents through the key measures that you've indicated on page 269?
Ms. Carlson.
Madam Chair, well, and Senator, Representative Erickson, they can be kept track of if they stay in the same district. I mean, the early childhood providers in the district are good at, and actually across some districts too are good with that. But as I indicated, they don't currently get MARS numbers, so we can't really track them from any kind of statewide perspective or any further away than that.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Erickson,
will that change in the governor's proposal, or is it just the other piece?
Madam Ms. Chair Carlson. And Representative Erickson, no, that should change. The giving of the MARS numbers would be hooked to the screening program, but it would certainly serve to identify those kids in all other aspects.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, then you'll remember if you go to page 270 that this is a combination state aid and levy program. I can tell you that in 2005, 47 districts will have no aid entitlement because their levy will be sufficient to run the program. So 120, you can read the formula. It's been fixed, the per child amount at $120.
Representative Biskins has a question, Ms. Carlson. I'm sorry to interrupt you again. Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this might go to staff. Is this levy fully, partially, or not equalized?
Madam Chair, Representative Biskins, the ECFE levy is a little bit of a different breed. What we do is we set the dollar amount in statute that we want to have raised, and then the rate changes each year as the base changes. Right now, most of the districts are on the formula, so to that degree, we would call it an equalized formula. Whether it's fully equalized or not is sort of hard because we have a different pupil base underlying it than we use for most of our formulas. We have the number of 0 to 4-year-olds in the district as our pupil base.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, and there is a requirement in statute to have a sliding fee scale in each district, and so registration fees and co-pays, if you will, are paid by parents to be in this program. I don't know, do you want me to walk through the cut from, I can kind of tell you the base reduction from 03 if I know you're hearing a lot of that.
Sure, we're hearing about it all the time, so go ahead and clarify it for us.
The aid entitlement in 2003, before the reductions, was $19,981,242. Now, there was then a 5% reduction to that, resulting in $19,065,526. The reduction, however, was composed of a couple of things. There was an excess fund balance penalty put into effect in that year, and that generated almost $55,000 of that cut. And then there was an unallotment of almost $37,000. And a proration of $124,000. So combined, there was over a $900,000 cut. But I just wanted to let you know that there's components to that cut.
Representative Grimes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Carlson, when I toured an ECFE program in my district last fall, they were talking about some of the ramifications of the cut and the less classes that they could offer and so forth. What kind of outcomes have you seen statewide in the cut to ECFE?
Madam Chair and Representative Grayling, we're hearing the same things, cuts in numbers of classes and hours of service. We don't do any kind of evaluation of outcomes of kids in this program, so I can't match that up to the cuts in services, but most often we're hearing, like you are, the cuts in numbers of classes.
Did you have more?
I was asked, I think Brett asked us to do first grade preparedness. Is that something you're interested in doing?
Yes.
An overview of? Okay. That is in another section of your budget book, is in the general ed section of your budget book.
It's essentially all day K, right?
It's the only all day kindergarten that we fund.
True. There are some around that we don't fund. Right. What page are you going to be on?
I think it's on page 79. And this is a program that the purpose is to take the sites where the highest levels of poverty are and to try and get intervene in there to ensure that kids have the opportunity before first grade that they're needed to be able to kind of get on par with other first graders and succeed in school. There were 73 sites funded in 2004. I believe in 2005 now we're funding 71 sites. But you can see that 3,440 kindergarten students participated. These on the statute requires this program to be developed in collaboration with the school readiness and early childhood providers in that district, and that it should complement the services that the district provides for with their comp ed revenue too. So there's supposed to be some similarity here among the way the programs operate. The districts are allowed to do home visits, so there may be that component, but primarily they're staying in the kindergarten classroom and having more intensive kindergarten experiences. The money is divided out into four kind of chunks, and there is a $7.2 million appropriation. It's divided among Minneapolis, St. Paul, metro suburban areas, and greater Minnesota. And then the sites are ranked on a percentage of students that qualify for free or reduced lunch. The ranking then, we just take as many sites as we can up to the appropriation.
Sorry, Representative Biskins. There's no graceful way to interrupt you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, a point. I've noticed that whenever anyone uses the phrase Greater Minnesota, Representative Heidgerken's face just lights up. question that I have, Madam Chair.
But there is one. Good.
Yes, there is. Ms. Carlson, would you say that the a large number of these sites use the additional funding to fund all-day kindergarten?
Madam Chair and Representative Biskins, yes, that is what they use the funding for.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I mean, is there anything else they can use it for other than all?
Well, they can use it for home visits, too. The legislation allows for that. But.
Okay. Representative Heidgerken.
Madam Chair, going over the formula, you could probably answer it. How did they arrive at the formula? When you look at the formula that two-thirds of the money is spent in the seven-county area here in metro area, when actually about half the people are in Greater Minnesota. Where did you come up with the formula?
Ms.
Madam Chair and Representative, I guess you all came up with the formula. I administer the program.
Touche, Representative. But it's based on a percentage of students in poverty qualifying for free and reduced lunch, and so the larger numbers.
Madam Chair, Representative Pedro, the reason there were four regions established when the program was first established as a pilot program for 3 years.
Okay.
And the reason for establishing four regions was that if you would put the money out statewide without dividing it into regions, nearly all of the money would have gone to either Minneapolis or St. Paul, because the schools that are in poverty in those two cities are at the top of the list. And so the thought was to divide it into four regions,
where suburban schools would get a fourth, and it's sort of arbitrary the amount of money, but a fourth of the money was put in each of those four regions, and that allowed both the greater Minnesota region and the suburban region to have participating schools, even though on average their percent of students eligible for the program is quite a bit lower than in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So that was the original reason for choosing the four regions.
Yeah. Madam Chair,
Representative.
To that point, so it's a good example, again, of where the free and reduced lunch program really does not work that effectively. When you consider that, I think of your 10 poorest counties in the state of Minnesota are all in greater Minnesota. It's just that the kids don't sign up for the program. And because of that, it's something we discussed before, but thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Sikora. Ms. Carlson, under key measures and the statistics that are there, are you able to break down whether it was greater Minnesota, the suburbs, Minneapolis, or St. Paul, where some of those gains might have been made?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, actually, I was just going to get to this point. And in the original legislation in 96, it called for the state to do an evaluation of the program. That then was subsequently taken out, the requirement was. But we have boxes of this information from 1996 and 97, and that's what these figures come from. So it's almost 10-year-old data by now. But I believe we have each assessment even by child. Is that correct? I'm looking. Yes. So we could break it out. We haven't broken it out like that. You know, we've just done a statewide profile. But we have the information collected like that, so we could do that.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, is there going to be any change so that we really can see whether or not this is helping, for example, Minneapolis and St. Paul children, or all children.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, well, the change has been that we don't do the evaluation anymore, and we just simply, I mean, the districts apply and get the money now. There's no, we offer even no technical assistance anymore to these sites. So there isn't any administrative money that comes with this. So we wouldn't be doing that. Particular to this program, specific to this program.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, is there a resource that a school district could use, however, to collect this data?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, yes, they could collect the data easily now on the same school readiness checklist that we've been using in our studies, in our statewide studies. And actually some of the districts have, you know, ended up participating in those studies too. So they would, it's a 32-item checklist and it would be easy to administer. Teachers do it themselves. And so, yes, they would be comparable then.
Madam Chair, it would seem to me that would be very important to elementary principals, you know, to be ready to have this data, to collect it and then use it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right about that. Anything else on first grade preparedness or any further questions on this? I don't know why we call it first grade preparedness rather than all day K. But there are all day K programs out there that are not under this particular program. Their districts are actually out there on their own doing it. Representative Cleansing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carlson, maybe we need more Mars numbers for this answer too, but my question is about the key measures listed here. I don't see one that compares them to kids who are in half day K. Do we have those numbers?
Madam Chair and
Ms. Carlson,
you're right. They don't. We don't have comparisons. We, when kids go to kindergarten, though, they do get a Mars number. So we can look at those retrospectively. We can look in the kindergarten class cohort and sift through and sift out half day, full day kindergarten, first grade preparedness. Yes.
Okay. How hard would that be to do, Ms. Carlson, if you would like to see that information?
I don't know that, Madam Chair, I don't know that it would be so hard to do. It would take some time, and we can do it.
Well, I don't want to, you know, push you if you are very short on time, but I think it's something that it would be nice that if within the next couple of weeks we could have that information so that we might better understand the impact of full-day K as opposed to some other kind of program.
That may be a bit soon, but we'll see what we can do, Madam Chair.
3 weeks? End of the month? End of the month.
Okay.
Deal?
Well, going once.
Representative Erickson.
Madam Chair, maybe we could motivate some of our university grad students to take this on and use it as their thesis.
Do they have access to this data?
Madam Chair, I believe they can. It's public data, correct? I'm looking. It's by child, though, so we can't. But couldn't we do it by Mars numbers?
We could
figure out a way where we
wouldn't
have
child.
To identify the child.
Okay. All right. Are there any further questions on first grade preparedness program?
So that was all I had, Madam Chair, because I'm going to bring the screening when we get the governor's bill.
Okay. As long as we have a little extra time, members, we're going to try and do this tomorrow, if we had extra time after the bills, but I would be very curious just in reactions to last week, Tuesday. We didn't get a chance to discuss it because we had to get the bonding stuff done last week and get through the budget. But if would be happy to have just a little open discussion here on, you know, what you felt you saw in Waseca. This isn't the time to run away, Representative.
I wouldn't think of doing that. Hands folded.
For that, we'll let you go first.
It was a lovely bus ride. I mean, a couple of things that stood out for me is the challenge that they raised in terms of making it work at the high school level. The generalizing, you know, when you've got the school, I think the school social worker was the master teacher there, which is an unusual choice to begin with, but then getting that person into the German class and the tech ed class and trying to generalize the teaching strategies across such diverse curriculum areas strikes me as a tough one. The other piece that I heard loud and clear, particularly I think it was from the first grade teachers that we observed, was the chronic problem in education of time. And we're not, this doesn't deal with that issue, and that issue seems to be the most critical one in terms of education. How do we increase time on task for kids, but how do we also ensure the teachers have the time that they need to actually implement a program like this and work through it. I was reminded of a now retired colleague of mine who was involved in his teaching career in implementing a number of new programs, and he said what you tended to find was the new programs were strong and effective for the first 3 to 5 years, and by that point the people who had developed and implemented them were exhausted. And they'd been doing the 70 and 80 hour a week thing to get the program established and functioning, and they were committed that at a certain point they kind of had to go back to their own families and find some more balance.
Who did you talk to about that?
This was a memory of a conversation with a retired colleague of mine who came up in hearing the discussion amongst the teachers that, you know, you can establish something and work it and make it successful for a period of time, but unless you structure in ways for it to continue to be successful, you wear out the people and you lose the effectiveness of the program. So how do you deal with the time issue in education was one of the questions that I walked away with.
Okay. Very good analysis. And if you need to go, you can be excused now.
I will dream of
it. Representative Klinzing.
Just a comment on the time thing. I was having a discussion on some school tours in Washington County. The schools that I was touring there, it came to my attention that when they moved to a 4-period day, their teachers negotiated to maintain a full 83-minute block of curriculum preparation time for their classrooms. But when the district I teach in moved to the 4-period day, the teachers were not able to negotiate that successfully and had to stick with the 55-minute prep period, which meant they owed the district 28 minutes of some other time. And I think that it comes down to a district, a commitment as a district, and in those negotiations when the teachers and the administration and everybody are committing to a mission and then negotiating a contract, that's where really the time issue gets decided. And we've seen that time and again. But I just wanted to comment on the time issue.
Did you have any further comments? Okay. Anybody else? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair. You know, as I've watched the development of St. Francis Teacher Academy, which I am quite sure they'll receive a grant award to begin that, I think it makes a difference if you create your own program versus take the teacher advancement program and embed it, because then from the ground up, you have looked at the time constraints, looked at curriculum, you've gotten rid of what it is that probably never needed to be there if you want to focus, as Waseca does, you know, on particular skill areas or learning areas that they felt they had weaknesses in and wanted to make the key learning areas for their students. I think we'll see a difference there, and if the governor's proposal becomes law, I do believe that as districts develop their teacher advancement program as part of the incentive, that we won't probably see or hear as much of the consternation that we did from some of the Waseca teachers, because they created it rather than having it. I really like teacher advancement placement, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I think we could make a mountain out of a molehill, actually, because it parallels so closely to what I did as a teacher, working in a program in Princeton called Teachers Helping Teachers. That was the Madeline Hunter model. And, you know, it was constantly working with teachers to improve skills. And I modeled, and I was like the master teacher. And I was also in my classroom full time. So what you do is, you know, you learn how to just zero in on what it is that the teacher wants to work on.
But there was probably no connection to performance as far as pay goes, or what?
No, there was no connection. No, that would be the new piece.
Okay.
But that's a logical piece. I'd love to have been rewarded or seen my fellow teachers get that.
All right. Representative Bernardi.
And Madam Chair, the thing I found interesting that day was how teachers really articulated how they aren't motivated by the bonuses. They're motivated by the students, helping students, as well as getting more time and meeting with other teachers. That seemed to be the value of the program to me. And I'm just wondering, are we putting a business model on top of teaching kids that really isn't the right fit and the right motivator for teachers? As far as I'm talking about bonuses for student performance, it's something that to look into. And I know that group did say, you know, once we start getting them, we may feel differently about it. But clearly, right now...
Yeah, they haven't seen the bonus yet.
Right, yeah. They haven't seen it yet. But right now, it really appeared that the time, meeting with other teachers, and helping students is their motivator.
But Madam Chair, I think the Milken Foundation has said in the end, it's pretty important to teachers to either have the incentive and the bonus or both.
Yeah. Over the long term, I think you'd probably like to have that reward incentive rather than just the pat on the back. And the pat on the back is great, and I do a ton for a pat on the back. But I think for, you know, a long term, when it's the job that you have at which you make your living, it's nice to get some compensation in dollars as well as in thank yous. Representative Griley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was my concern about the program, was that the Milliken offered so much more funding to schools than I think the governor's proposal will be able to. And, you know, and then when we had our small groups and we got more candid answers perhaps from the teachers, some of them said, at least in the group I was in, that they might not have voted to do it without that extra funding. And then once they got into it, then they went into those were the benefits. But right away when we talked to the principal, what would you do when this grant runs out? You know, he said right off the bat where they would cut would be the teacher
the teacher bonuses would have to be paired back. And, you know, considering how hard they were working, I was so energized by looking at the model, and I might have stayed in teaching myself longer than 5 years if I'd had a model like that, because they had immediate feedback, they were collegial instead of isolated, and they knew what worked and got some help with what didn't. So I thought the model was just excellent. But I think when you want teachers to work so hard and they're already working so hard, then to right away, as soon as the money is scarce, the first thing we do is cut those bonuses. And then I wondered, you know, long term, then does that mean the teachers have been schnookered into this weekend work and all this other work, and then we, you know, they're working so hard, but then they don't get the bonuses, you know, if we don't have the money. That was my long-term fear. But I was very impressed with how they were working, and I also was exhausted for them in talking to them.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I agree, and I have the same observation Representative Bernardi had in terms of the impressed nature, the people, and how impressed they were with what it did for student achievement, and that, you know, it did get them in, the bonuses did get them into it, but that wasn't going to be the holding power. But I do really believe that does need to be there, that kind of reward, and not necessarily because they're there for that reason, but that's the way I think we keep the best and the brightest. Another thought that I had, you know, I was also listening in on the ones when they commented about teaching, being up there working on Sundays and this and that, and you know, quite frankly, I've observed a lot of teachers that go up on Sundays and spend a lot of time, and so I didn't think that was totally unusual, but it was very impressive, and to see the motivation that they had, and I guess what really struck me over above the whole thing was just how excited the teachers were about the impact it had on student performance. Bottom line, that was really what seemed to get them excited. And what I had to think back on is the teaching commission. And the report they had about improving our excellence and empowering teachers and how they can have the best influence on the outcomes of our kids. And this was kind of a local affirmation of what was a large national study, that if we find a way to help teachers develop professionally, we can improve the performance of kids. And this was a local affirmation of that on a national level. I thought that was very interesting.
Actually, I think tomorrow, I'm expecting we'll finish our bills a little early, because I was hoping that we'd have time at the end for this discussion. And I didn't realize it, but the Reading First people are here today and expected to give, a little report on Reading First. And so I would ask Jesse Montano to come up, and you have the last whatever time we have there, 15 minutes. And in the meantime, Representative Erickson, you had a comment.
I visited with Dell, who had taught in the College of Education at Mount Carmel University. And my question to her was, is she seeing within the Colleges of Education this model? And she assured me that when she was on the staff at Minnesota University Mankato, that she had introduced that, and she was hopeful that now this would be picked up by other schools of education, so that it happens prior to the teacher getting into the classroom. They come with that, with those skills from the teacher advancement program.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Montano, and I am sorry.
Not a problem.
I did not realize that that we were going through Reading First today. My problem.
Madam Chair, thank you. Jesse Montano with the Department of Education, NCLB programs, and I will keep this very short. We were asked last week if we had some results as to how effective the Reading First program was. What we put together was a very brief summary, just some of the highlights. Know that this is the first year of Reading First, so we don't have results for Reading First. What I'm going to share with you are a few of the highlights from the Reading Excellence program. The Reading First program is just an extension of Reading Excellence, so I'll just share with you a few highlights of the Reading Excellence. You have a handout, Madam Chair. The first page is just looks like this. It's called Minnesota Department of Education and CLB Consolidated Programs. It's just actually it's just a summary of some of the information I'm going to present to you so you can look at it at your leisure. The first thing on your handout is a list of the schools. We have a list of the Reading First schools, as you can see from your handout. We do have the charter school, we have Bemidji, Bloomington, etc., Brooklyn Center. The district is on the handout. Then you've got the school and the principal. So you have a list of the Reading First schools. Then you also have a list of the Reading Excellence schools. It looks like this. In that list, you have Anoka, Hennepin, Deer River, Duluth, etc., Minneapolis, St. Paul, Robbinsdale, and so forth, with the schools that participated. In terms of eligibility, you've got a separate handout, and on that handout it says to be eligible for Reading First, a school district must meet the criteria in at least one cell in each column. So you either have to be one school district with above the median percent in third grade reading scores, or 100 or more third grade students receiving non-proficient scores on the MCA. In addition to one or the other of those, you must have either 15% or more of the student population in poverty, and that's census data, not free reduced lunch, or 500 or more students in poverty. I won't read the others, but that's the eligibility that the district must meet in order to be eligible. Then the district, in turn, selects the schools that will apply. The first information I just want to share with you is it's important to look at the demographics of the schools that were in Reading Excellence. So we had a total of, in terms of Reading Excellence, 23 schools. The average poverty in those schools was 74%. The ELL population was 21%. Of those schools that were in Reading Excellence, we have 27 schools now in Reading First. We had 23 Reading Excellence, 27 Reading First. The demographics are, again, 71% poverty, 23% ELL populations, and that's the average.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I don't have that handout. Is that supposed to be in the packet? Or?
No, if I think it came separately, and maybe...
I was out of my chair.
You were out of your chair, Representative Rodman. Which we know is a bad place to be, right?
Madam Chair, of the 27 Reading First schools, 18 of those are new schools with an average poverty rate of 67 and ELL population of 25. 9 of the Reading First schools are a continuation of Reading Excellence. They reapplied and were granted an additional grant, and the average poverty for those schools is 79% and with an ELL population of 18%. The poverty rate here is calculated on free and reduced lunch as opposed to the eligibility, which is census, so there's a difference in those populations. Very briefly, I think I shared with you last week that one of the things that happens to these schools is that each school is assigned what we call a data collection expert. This is an expert that goes in and does some assessments and also does observations. And one of the things that these people do are in the schools once a week, and they observe teachers. I just want to share with you briefly some of the results that we're seeing. If you look at the first column, year one is green, year two is yellow. And you, the first column basically are low-level types of questions, not your higher-order type questions. And as you can see, what we're looking for is that those columns go down. Higher-order thinking skill questions are the next column. We're pleased to see that the type of questions that teachers are asking in terms of higher-order thinking skills is increasing. The third is in terms of the skills that teachers are using, and the last is strategies. Again, as you recall, this is a professional development model that provides teachers training with respect to the five domains of reading, and so it's heavily focused on those five domains. Each one of those domains is assessed separately, differently, using different assessments, and teachers get weekly feedback. This is just an example of some of the results we're seeing, that teachers are starting to look at what's in terms of scientifically based research practices that have been proven to be effective, that we are starting to see changes in teacher behavior, and that's ultimately what we want to see. One other thing I want to share with you, one of the assessments that we use for comprehension is the Gates-McGinnis. If you look at the handout that you have in front of you, again, this is reading excellence. Grade 2, if you look, the green, that is fall testing. The yellow is spring testing, so you can already begin to see that we are seeing results in terms of comprehension scores for the students, and those are very positive results, and so we are seeing that this is doing a lot in terms of closing that achievement gap. Then finally, briefly, what I want to share is what our test results are starting to look at. If you look at the left column, that's state average. And if you go to the little handout that summarizes what we have, in terms of state average, our average for poverty is 28%, and the average ELL population is 6%. So those are the results you see on the left. If you look at the right, those are the schools that were in reading excellence, and I want to remind you again that the demographics look very different, that you're talking 74% poverty and 21% of those students are ELL. And as you can see, our scores from 02, 03, and 04 are increasing, and we feel that's very positive. So I think that, Madam Chair, is what the committee was looking for in terms of does a good professional development model that is sustained, ongoing, and provides teachers the support, coaching, mentoring in the classroom. Are they successful? Do they work? I think the answer to that is yes.
Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Montano? None. Thank you so much. You must have done it, made a great presentation, because nobody has a question. And this group always has questions. So, we need to look at the minutes. And the minutes are pretty quick read today. Representative Erickson, did you have a chance to look at them?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes from February 3, 05.
Any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have made it. I wanted to mention to you, in case you haven't heard yet, that we have some very, very sad news, and that's that Doug Meslow's son, Peter, died apparently early this morning. And so I hope you will all keep him in your prayers and your thoughts, because I don't think this was quite expected at this point in time, so it makes it much tougher. So anyway, it's kind of a sad day for all of us, because Peter was a real trooper and a real fighter. And they, as a family, they had a wonderful attitude, and I just think we all need to do everything we can to help them through this. So with that, I'll see you all tomorrow, where we will be taking up some the Carpenter bus bills and a couple of early childhood ECFE-type bills. Thanks. Meeting is adjourned.